I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. When times are tough or when I'm tired of incessant political discourse, I often thumb through my books of poetry just to get away from the onslaught of bad news and all the hyperbole and meaningless language. Luckily, the Delaware Valley is home to a number of accomplished poets, two of whom join us today on Radio Times. They both have new collections of poetry. Daisy Fried's new collection is Women's Poetry, Poems, and Advice. Her poems have been published in The Nation, The New Republic Poetry, and The Threepenny Review. And Daisy Fried, it's been more than a decade. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you here. Lynn Levin's new collection is titled Miss Plastique, and she's co-author with Valerie Fox of a book called Poems for the Writing Prompts for Poets. And Lynn Levin, it's been a number of years as well, and thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be back.
I do want to begin with actually the title poems for both of your books, and Daisy Fried, if I can begin with you.
Well, Marianne Moore has a famous, very short poem called Poetry, and it goes like this. I, too, dislike it. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers in it, after all, a place for the genuine. So my poem is called Women's Poetry. I, too, dislike it. However, I was trying to not think when out of the gaping wound of the car detailing garage, smells like metallic sex, came a Nissan GTR fitted with an oversized spoiler. Backing out sounded like clearing the throat of God. A gold snake zizzed around the license plate. Sunburst hubcaps, fancy undercarriage installation casting a pool of violet light on the pocked pavement of gum blots. Was it this that filled me with desire?
That's a great poem. I want to get back to you. And that's a Daisy Fried reading a poem called Women's Poetry. Now, Lynn, I'd love to have you read your title poem.
Okay. Miss Plastique. Because it should be handled with care and can explode at any moment, it is like me. Picture a gob of it molded into the three graces, shock, orgasm, and wrath. Watching the man from Uncle, I thrilled to see Ilya Kuryakin pack plastique into a keyhole, then coolly turn as it blew open a door. Imagine, something that looks like dough can kill you. I love the stuff, with a self-love I never knew I had, more than my stiletto heels, garbo hat, or lipsticks. I want to wrap some up like bubblegum and give it to my enemy. Here, take me into your mouth. Taste me.
That's Lynn Levin reading Miss Plastique from her new collection of poems. And Daisy, let me go back to you and just to underscore what Marianne Moore said and what you're saying in this poem as well. I mean, the idea that poetry, I dislike it. And yet, here it is, right?
Well, I think what Marianne Moore does is she makes liking poetry or disliking poetry kind of irrelevant. You know, I like individual poems. I dislike individual poems. I need poetry.
Right. And the idea of this poem, the idea of women's poetry and putting it into a garage and all the smells and the sounds of a garage.
Well, what's funny is when the poem started out, it was a long poem in which I was pushing a baby in a stroller, and I ran into a friend, and it describes a lot of different stuff and a conversation, and then a car drives out, and it wasn't called Women's Poetry at the time, and none of it was working except the car image. So I cut off all the rest of it, and then it occurred to me to call it Women's Poetry. And of course women's poetry is about cars, you know?
Of course it is.
It's about everything. So.
Of course it is. And then on the cover of your book, you have just a lovely Barbie doll, you know, all decked out in a kind of bustier, a necklace, some nice earrings, blonde hair.
Well, I have to say one little thing. Barbie has become kind of a generic term for a fashion doll, and she is actually Jet, one of the Dynamite girls from Integrity Toys. She's actually not a Barbie, but she is a fashion doll, and she's in the genre of the Barbie.
And was there a reason you didn't pick Barbie, but you picked Jet?
First of all, Barbie belongs to the poet Denise Duhamel, who has a whole series of Barbie poems. And also, you know, Barbie's been done a lot. And my publisher, Ellen Foose, said I should pick a retro doll. And so we combed through millions of images of retro dolls, and I finally found jet, and she worked beautifully.
Well, I love the way her head is kind of cocked as well, looking at you.
Yeah, it's all the way these people photograph the dolls, too.
Daisy, your book is called Women's Poetry, and I have to say, when I read that title, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm back in college. It's 1972. We're in a class about women's poetry. Were you kind of playing with that?
The title is Utterly Sincere and Utterly Tongue-in-Cheek. Yes. So some people who will remain nameless were concerned that people would think it was an anthology of second-wave women's poetry, feminist
poetry.
Perish
the thought, right?
But I have on my cover a artwork by the Philadelphia artist Judith Schechter, and it's a little bald devil girl who's kind of cringing, and over her head is a bomb dropping out of an old-fashioned airplane, and I sort of think that will assist in the tongue-in-cheek right. part of it.
But the tongue-in-cheek is sort of just playing with these notions about poetry?
That's part of it, yeah. And, you know, I started writing this book, I had just had a baby. My daughter's six now. And I was writing a lot of stuff about being a mom and pregnancy and things like that. And I was like, oh, no, I'm going to be typed as a mommy poet.
Yes, exactly.
And actually, my husband, who often has great advice, says, just meet it head on. And so once I had the title poem, Women's Poetry, and once I had a sequence of advice, poetry advice letters that I included, which is called Ask the Poetess, I just felt it coming together and saying, you know, these poems are about women's stuff, but they're not ever only about that. So, yeah.
How do you think about women's poems or poetry, Lynn? Does that mean anything to you?
Actually, not that much. This particular book of mine has all female voices, so it's much more unified in terms of its focus. But I usually think of poetry as for humans. It's about being human. But, I mean, of course, if you're talking about motherhood and you're talking about special women's issues, it has to be about female things.
Right.
But
about humans. I mean, it's interesting you said it that way.
Yeah, it's about being human.
It is actually sometimes necessary still to declare that women's experience is human experience.
Right. Even in 2013, you think.
Yeah.
What do you think about Poetry Month, Lynn? I'm so ambivalent about it.
Well, for one thing, it gives organizations that would not normally host poets kind of a really good reason to host poets. So I love that. I mean, for me, Poetry Month is every month of the year. But, you know, certain libraries and organizations want that as an occasion. And, I mean, it makes it very exciting for us poets. You know, there's millions of readings to go to and hopefully sometimes share your own poems at readings. So I think it's a lovely invention. It should continue.
What do you think, Daisy? And then I want to hear some more poems as well.
Oh, you know, pretty much the same. I mean, someone pointed out that we usually have months for things that are somewhat marginalized. So,
like Black History Month.
Black History Month, all kinds of stuff like that. So it's a publicity thing, you know, but I think anything that helps people come to poetry and feel comfortable with poetry is good.
Lynn, I'd love to have you read, you have some Lilith poems in here. Mm-hmm. First, if you can talk about why she interests you. And she has, of course, she's from the Bible. She's an interesting relationship with Adam.
Right. Well, she's a little non-biblical. She's not really in the Bible, but she was in legend, supposed to be Adam's first wife. And she was the self-assertive woman in the bedroom and in other places, and this kind of upset Adam, who then kicked her out. And then she became a demoness who caused a lot of trouble with pregnancies and things like that. So Lilith in legend has been given a bad rap. But currently, Lilith has been made into a heroine in a lot of ways. There's the Lilith Music Festival and the magazine Lilith. So I see her as someone who's been mistreated and needs some respect. So that's why I have these four Lilith poems. So in Lilith's Quilt, she is an older woman now. And here's Lilith's Quilt. Older, moon-swept no more. Lilith saw bed as a place to sleep, but sleep abandoned her, like the millions of guys she'd had. Every night she tossed and turned with memories of her god-awful sex life. Lovers who woke up terrified, dumped her out of the sack, mocked her desire. Did a man ever live who could mix with her body and soul? To court slumber, Lilith began to stitch a quilt, a gift for her bed. Each morning she gathered scraps of colorful fabric, appliqued scenes of the good life. Families at supper, workers at work, weddings, births, kisses in the park. By afternoon, squares of human happiness spread before her like the funnies in the newspaper. Her scenes itched for a little disappointment. But how much disappointment did the good life allow? A setback once a season, a letdown once a week, once a day? Lilith drove herself nuts with self-doubt. Just before bed, she would take a seam ripper to her beautiful squares, then collapse on her sheets. Every morning, same story. Lilith got up craving sleep like caffeine, purple purses under her eyes. She would gather her scraps of colorful cloth and pat her bed. Old friend, she would say, this time I will finish the quilt, and then we will sleep like lambs.
Hmm. Lynn Levin reading a book, a poem from her new collection of poems. That one is called Lilith's Quilt. And Lynn, the poem right before that, which I love, speaking of Lilith, Lilith at the cosmetics counter. I mean, you put her in all sorts of interesting situations.
Yeah, she's girlfriends with Eve now. They go shopping. They take a nature walk. And you know, like a lot of women, she is very attracted to the cosmetics counter. There's always the promise of beauty and youth and stuff. And ultimately, she almost gets talked into buying a whole load of cosmetics by the sales lady who...
I know that feeling.
Right? Yeah. And it might have been an offer there with some free goods. But then she starts to distrust this sales lady, also because she's got false eyelashes so thick she gave everyone the hairy eyeball. And she remembers some advice an old lover once gave her, which was, don't ever buy makeup from anyone who's not as good looking as you. And that sort of says, oh, she pivots away from that.
Well, it's funny because looking at the doll on the front of your book and then Lilith, it's almost, these poems remind me of playing with dolls. I mean, taking a doll and putting them into a certain situation and, you know, they have friends and then they have frenemies and all the things that dolls do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful way of putting it, Marty, actually.
But do you think of this as sort of a narrative of Lilith or just your take on this really interesting character?
Well, the Lilith poems are a narrative about Lilith. And I was even going to write more of them, and I still might. But, you know, sometimes she's younger and fearful of snakes, and sometimes she's trying on clothes, and then at one point Eve and Lilith wonder if they're gay. And so... But like a lot of the characters in this book, she's also interested in hair and makeup, sometimes attracted to it and sometimes spurns it. So all these – the accoutrements of female beauty and dolling oneself up are very much a motif through the book.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then, Daisy, I want to have you read another poem as well. And we are talking with two poets today on Radio Times, two poets here who live here in the Delaware Valley. Lynn Levin's new book is called Miss Plastique, and Daisy Fried's new book is called Women's Poetry, Poems, and Advice. Daisy Fried is a member of the faculty at Warren Wilson College's Low Residency MFA program and a lecturer in creative writing at Bryn Mawr College. Lynn Levin teaches poetry at Drexel University and the University of Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called the ENACT Project at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is funded by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-8400. 215-762-8400.
I'm Marty Moscowain, reminding you that your financial support makes all the difference here at WHYY. We get more than half of our budget from you when you make a pledge of support, 1-888-345-9499, or pledge online at WHYY.org. You're listening to Radio Times, a program that talks about everything. Today, U.S. foreign policy and poetry. How cool is that? 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra performs the music of Johannes Brahms. Donald Runicles conducts Brahms' Second Symphony. And Jonathan Biss plays Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 13. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online, philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Mozart and Brahms with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with poets Daisy Fried and Lynn Levin. In fact, if you want to catch up with Lynn, she'll be at Perch Pub on May 14th at Broad and Locust Streets here in Philadelphia at 8 o'clock, and on May 17th at the Doylestown Bookshop at 6:30. And of course, you can talk to her right here on Radio Times if you give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Daisy, I'd love to have you read Midnight Feeding, and you talked about the fact that as a mom of a young child, that caused or created a lot of poetry, not surprisingly.
Well, I feel there are three rules for poetry, and one is never write about kittens, write about babies, and never write about getting drunk. So, Midnight Feeding.
Here we go.
The open shed on the lawn's far side stinks of gas. From the hateful mower that pulls me where it wants when I mow, which is seldom, I rip up grass. Humid nights, moons, nothing halo. The lawn pretends to candy floss. Black-white dud roses dead since June, alive enough to scratch my bare legs. I'm wearing nothing but underpants, flip-flops, arms full. I stumble out, flashlight in my mouth, turn my head to choose what's lit. Inside the dirt floor shed, I fill bowls, dry bits, tuna slop. The flashlight hurts my mouth till I drop it, dwindles into its cone, where it falls to blight a denticular leaf. Raphael, Gabriel, Lucifer! Feral kittens come running, vicious, filthy. Hum of the road. Uriel shines his reflector eyes from among mower parts in the shed's darkest corner. Disgust shakes his paw. He won't get close since wild La Mama ran off weeks ago. My three-month daughter cries on the baby monitor. I wear like a Miss America sash. She'll wait. Uriel must eat. Can't leave them. Coons or coyotes would get the food, and kittens, too. My fur rises on my arms. What a bad mom. Also, I refuse to look at the stars. There are too many stars in poems you have to get drunk to write.
And again, Daisy Fried reading a poem called Midnight Feeding. So you broke just about all those rules in this. Well, the kittens...
Anytime anybody gives you a rule about poetry, the first thing you have to do is break it.
Right.
I break my own rules, so whenever possible.
Was there a particular inspiration for this? Because it's very vivid. I mean, I feel like I can see it all. You know.
I actually live in South Philly, and my backyard is actually a tiny little cement courtyard, and I have a tree outside in front that's in a curb, you know, a sidewalk cut. So this is not my house. I do have a friend in the suburbs with outdoor cats who described how she carried the heavy the bowls out to the shed for the cats and held the flashlight in her mouth. And I kind of took it.
I like
from
that
there.
Image of the flashlight in the mouth.
Yeah, it sounds like it hurts. I didn't actually do research to find out, but yeah.
The next poem you have, which I unfortunately can't have you read, only just because it's just too long, and that's not a criticism, but it's called Kissinger at the Louvre, and it begins where we see Kissinger, you know, getting out of a town car in front of the Louvre.
Which really happened. I was in Paris with my husband and daughter, a baby, and we were at the Louvre that morning, and we're hurrying home so she could be home by nap time. And, you know, the thing about a lot of the poems in here is the baby is kind of a prop, but there's always something else going on. So in that one, it's kind of about Kissinger, and this poem took place when we were there. Obama had not yet been elected president, but we were really hoping we were done with all the, you know, Bush and all those guys. So, in the end, Kissinger gets deleted from a photos from somebody's phone.
In your poem.
In my poem. And I think of that as kind of a hopeful moment when we can move on politically. But Lynn, yeah.
Well, you can do that in poetry, right?
Yeah.
Lynn, I know that you work as a translator, which I think is an interesting thing for a poet to do, because my narrow, shallow understanding of translation would be just the ability to get inside another language, obviously, and to get inside what words mean and how words sound and look on a page.
Yeah, it's part of the fascination of translating, and also immersing myself. I actually translate a Peruvian Andean poet named Odie Gonzalez, and it became a specialty for me. It's a funny, weird chain of events, but I ended up immersing myself in this Quechua culture of the high Andes, which is you couldn't find anything further from my own experience. But, you know, now I can talk about Inca this and Inca that and what you drink and what you eat and all these localities. Not that I have them on the tip of my tongue right now, but it was quite a journey.
Do you think that influenced you as a poet? I mean, just how you think about words, language?
Odie Gonzalez's style is influencing me. He often writes in fragments and sometimes uses what they call an open field, meaning gaps on the page of different lineations, mm-hmm. sort of skips around the page. And he writes in fragments a lot. And usually I write in very complete sentences, very grammatically, syntactically, quote-unquote, normal.
Right.
So I am trying to, like, loosen up and imitate his style. It's been an influence mm-hmm. on me.
And Daisy, you I remember when you were writing for some of the weeklies here in Philadelphia,
right.
You were a journalist for a while.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of my poems still start with kind of external observation or, you know, as I said with Midnight Feeding, somebody tells me a story and I'll mm-hmm. write it down. And the challenge is always to, you know, how do you make description or reportage into a poem? And it's partly a matter of getting the right music, but it's also partly a matter of in some way, for me, making it personal, making it happen to me, which is something you don't really do as a journalist.
No,
it's not supposed
no.
to happen to you. So,
But you have to sort of, I mean, in journalism, you have to, especially for print, what's left of it, is you know, be able to fit, you know, 140 words or something like mm-hmm. that. I mean, to fit that into, to describe something that happened in a very pointed and direct kind of way.
Yeah, well, and the, you know, the task is really the same in poetry. You are trying to get the detail that will give you the whole picture. So there's a lot of similarities, you know.
And that's Daisy Fried, who joins us along with Lynn Levin, and they are both poets here in the Delaware Valley and are joining us today on Radio Times to talk about poetry and to read from their collections, their new collections. Lynn Levin's is called Miss Plastique, and Daisy Fried's Women's Poetry, Poems, and Advice. We'll get to the advice part as well. I do want to have them read some more poems as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Bernadette from Doyle Town to join us. And Bernadette, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Margaret.
Hi,
it's a great show, as
Thank
always.
You. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm calling for Lynn. Well, it's Bernadette. I had a question about how you order your poems when you're finished a manuscript. You know, it's not like fiction where it's sequential and that's there's no question. But you have that reputation, or your work does, of being very eclectic. So, you know, how do you decide on the order of the entire book?
First, hi, Bernadette. In this case, Miss Plastique, I kind of categorized them as some prologue poems, things that usually are kind of provocative in some way. Though that's the first section, and then there are poems of girlhood, and then poems of marriage, and then the Lilith poems and the poems that are a little more contemplative or in a later section. So I kind of grouped them in that way. So they're not chronological. They're sort of thematically grouped.
Do you think about how poems are grouped in a book, Daisy?
Oh, sure, yeah. I don't think about it while I'm writing the poems. I don't write to preconceived themes or strategies. Some people do, and it works for them. But what happens is when I have enough poems that I think are good poems, I will start to arrange them. Philip Larkin, the British poet, just said probably about 30 or 40 years ago, he thinks of ordering poems as putting together a record album, the fast one, the slow one, the happy one, mm-hmm. the sad one. Uh-huh. And you try to get just a sort of dynamic feeling through the whole book. And that's really about it. I think that my poems tend to have thematic similarities simply because I do write from my own life, however fictionally and obliquely. Right. So since I'm working with certain experiences, whatever I'm experiencing at the time will be over, you know, 5 years, yeah. 6 years it takes to write a book, will be have common themes and strands.
Yeah. I like the fact that you said that when a poem is good. I mean, for you, you know when a poem is good. I mean, it has to feel right to you, right?
Actually, you know, excellence might be impossible to judge in your own work, and perhaps in anyone else's contemporary's work. But I think when I think it's done, it feels necessary, like it had to happen. The zillion choices that go into writing a poem all got made as best they could.
The kind of urgency that you felt got satisfied somehow. Well, I'd love to have some more poems. And Lynn, I pulled out Insomniac Romance.
That's a good segue from Philip Larkin, because the first line is modeled after a line of his poem, one of his poems. Insomniac Romance. We hate to hate each other, but we do. Then feeling bad because of that, we lay us next to next in bed, two statues on a tomb. We want to crash to sleep, but can't, reliving meannesses and fights that flicker past as dumb shows in the cemetery light. But leave you? I do not think I could. I like what carries on. I like the in and out sound of your breath and your warm skin, my steadfast partner, in the practice death.
In the practice death. Where did that poem come from? And then, Daisy, I'd love to have you read inside all this.
Well, I can't quote the line of the Larkin poem because it has a non-FCC word in it. But
gotcha.
It's the rhythm of that. And I love the rhythm of they blank you up, your mom and dad. They do not mean to, but they do. I love the rhythm of that, and it just carried me. And I thought, well, I'd like to write something in that mode. And then I got this idea of the cemetery light, meaning, you know, a very nocturnal but fatal kind of illumination. And then there's a lot of death imagery, but there's also the idea that, you know, sometimes you quarrel and you get mad at each other, and yet you don't want to break up.
Yeah. Well, I love the beginning, maybe that rhythm, we hate to hate each other, but we do.
Mm-hmm.
Daisy, I'd love to have you read, as I said, Inside All This.
Sure. Inside All This. Worn Eeyore in lavender, fur on Tigger, a braiding. The tag sale mobile dangles its dolls and mirrors. Inside all this, a baby laid on its stomach, irritably scraping its face back and forth in its sleep. Snail trails of snot widening and widening on its eczema'd face and over the sheets, like soap the squeegee man fans on the outside of a store window, till the baby's nearly awake in fear or rage or half-consciousness, which are only all need. So you pick it up before it wakes, in time to fold it in the darkness of your body. It cries awake anyway, because you were so happy you picked it up before it cried. Because wrestling up out of sleep comes from nowhere in the mind, like the whooped-up, druggy partying of soldiers behind a sieged barricade. Because otherwise, dying or something gets remembered. Bring me to the singing place. Bring me to the singing place. Bring me to the singing place. Locks on doors, bolts shoot loose, big bare hands on bare big shoulders.
Mm. And again, Daisy Fried reading a poem, Inside All This, big bare hands on bare big shoulders. It's a mouthful, isn't it?
I often find that when I'm reading my poems out loud, I think I'm interested in slightly strange syntax.
Are you?
And so I'm always playing with that. And then I come to them in a reading and I say, okay, I've got to pay attention because it's going to switch. It's going to be inverted in some way.
Well, I love the image of this baby waking up and sort of like soldiers, you know, sort of waking up in a kind of druggy, partied state.
Yeah, you know, I think about politics and I think about babies and I think about all kinds of things and I want them all to be in my poems. And so one of the ways to link unlike things is through, you know, metaphor or simile. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to get at that state of that sort of midnight fog of the baby, you know, caring for the baby in the middle of the night. So.
And you were nodding your head, Lynn, about the idea of, caring about babies, caring about politics, caring about everything and wanting them to be in
yes.
your poem.
I love that idea of mixing things that wouldn't normally go together and then creating metaphors or just putting a huge grab bag of imagery into a poem. It makes poetry so interesting.
Did you read poetry as a kid? I mean, was poetry has poetry been a part of your life?
Yes, it's always been a part of my life. When I was very young, my aunt Connie gave me a book of poetry called The Big Golden Book of Poetry, and it had a picture of the owl and the pussycat on the front.
I had that one too.
Oh my God, it's a generative book. And I read it till it fell to pieces.
Really?
I loved that book. It had funny poems and then fanciful poems.
What does the train say? Jiggle, jaggle, jiggle, jaggle. What does the train say? Jiggle, jaggle, gee.
Go ahead.
I can't pick up. You got me there. I don't remember that one. I remembered James Whitcomb Riley and, you know, The Owl and the Pussycat and The Little Land of Counterpane and Ogden Nash funny stuff.
And did you say, I want to write this? I want to be a poet like these
yeah.
poets in this book?
It took me on a magic carpet ride. I just loved it. And it was, you know, I was bad at gym and bad at math, but I could rhyme. And then, you know, that pat on the back that the teacher gives you, that little bit of encouragement, goes mm-hmm. a long way with a student.
And who was that teacher?
Well, there were various different elementary school teachers, but when I got to junior high school, there was a teacher named Mrs. Marion Hay. And in fact, I dedicate Miss Plastique to Mrs. Hay because one day she took me aside and she said, you know, I really like this poem that you wrote, and we're going to print it in the school literary magazine. And I thank Mrs. Hay. She was the first person who really made me think that I could write poetry.
Wow.
And speaking of those things that Daisy said you should never put in a poem, you know, cats and kittens and being drunk and stuff, Mrs. Hay always said, don't ever write about poetry. Don't ever write poems about poetry. And then the one poem I ever wrote about poetry is about Mrs. Hay.
You got her.
Yeah.
But she sounds
Sorry, Mrs.
great.
Hay.
No, it's okay. How about for you, Daisy? Did you grow up with poetry?
Well, my parents are both readers, and my father wrote poetry, although he stopped. But he was a published poet in his 20s. But I never particularly wanted to be a poet, but I always did writing things. And I actually was a jock, too. So I was a competitive swimmer and a volleyball player and later a rugby player. But I always did do writing as well, and I always wrote poems here and there, and mm-hmm. I wrote stories here and there, and I guess I got serious about it more in my mid-20s.
Do you know why?
Couple reasons. You know, I always wrote the poetry for the drawer, but I was working as a journalist in my mid-20s, and the deadline got me sort of just more rigorous about producing things, and I got less satisfied with journalism, more interested in poetry, and was able to just write it in a more sort of serious, continuous way. And I also fell in love with another writer, and we encouraged each other. So those
that
were
helps.
The two things that happened. And then it became necessary, and I couldn't stop. So,
well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and some more poetry as well, talking with Daisy Fried and Lynn Levin. They are both poets here in the Philadelphia area, and they both have new collections of poetry. Daisy's is called Women's Poetry, Poems and Advice. And as I said, we will get to the advice part, I promise. And Lynn Levin's new book is called Miss Plastique. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener supports WHYY. A graduate degree from Widener University is designed to help be the difference in your career. Widener University offers graduate degrees in programs including business process innovation and more. Registration at widener.edu/graduate.
The Philadelphia Science Festival supports WHYY and is back April 18th through the 28th. What makes exercise clothing sweatproof? Why do Philly soft pretzels taste so good to locals? Why did ancient Egyptians remove brains from bodies before mummification? The answers to these and many other riddles will be explored at science cafes throughout the city. Tickets and information available at phillyscientifestival.org. That's phillyscientifestival.org.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're in the very first day, first few hours of the spring membership campaign here at WHYY. And just like you, we've had to tighten our belts and we have to pay our bills. And that's where you come in. We're thrilled that you listen. We'd be even happier when you become a member. It's very simple. Decide what Radio Times and all the programs here at WHYY is worth and then make a call. 1-888-345-9499 or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks so much.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with two poets, Lynn Levin and Daisy Freed, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Lynn, I have to say, when I read To Arrival, I was going home on the train. I laughed out loud. What can I say?
Thank you.
It's a really fun poem. Could you read it for us?
Sure. To Arrival. Some say the world is big enough for all of us, but I think you take up too much space in the book review section. I hate the way you, in the destructive element, immerse your meters in swift procession of tropes, your book prize, your Japanese garden. Here's the worst. Every time I see you with him, I feel the same hot surge I felt when I realized I'd left the copper kettle on high, all the water boiled out, and I almost burned down my house. Thank God your nose looks like a can opener. Or I'd have another reason to detest your ingenious blend of the sentimental and sarcastic. But if you phoned and said, let's go out to lunch, I think, R, we could be friends.
And who is R? Well, does R know who
R just stands for rival there.
Yeah, okay. Did you have someone in mind, though, when you wrote that?
Yeah. But then I used various initials, and every time I used a random initial, someone would say, oh, is that so-and-so? Mm. And then I would change it, and they think, oh, that's so-and-so, and so I'd change it to something safe.
I'll get her to tell me later. I'll
know. I love the can opener nose. Did you have fun writing that?
Yeah, it was hilarious. Once I actually did leave the stove on, I got distracted, and then the copper kettle turned all red, and it was really scary, and So that was an image from life.
Well, it works really nicely in this poem. Daisy, I'd love to have you. Well, let's get to the advice part of this book.
Great. So the poetess, this is called Ask the Poetess, an advice column, and it's 9 or 10 pages long. I'll read a short bit of it. The poetess is she's a narcissistic know-it-all with a heart of gold, and she bears isn't any resemblance to real persons is entirely coincidental. So people write to her and ask for poetry advice. She answers, "Dear poetess, who do you think was the greatest poetess of the 20th century? Sarah Teasdale or Adelaide Crapsey?" Signed, Wondering. The poetess says, "Dear Wondering, a usage note at dictionary.com states, quote, many critics have argued that there are sexist connotations in the use of the suffix ESS to indicate a female in words like sculptress, waitress, stewardess, and actress. The heart of the problem lies in the non-parallel use of terms to designate men and women. The poetess has long felt that women's equality should be founded in the notion that a woman is no worse than a man. So it stands to reason that men are just as bad as women. The poetess applies the term poetess to men and women, good poetesses and bad." And then she goes on to say that Charles Bukowski is the greatest poetess of the 20th.
Well, the word poetess, do people even use that word?
There was a sort of minor movement recently to sort of reclaim the word poetess.
Herstory?
Herstory or, I say queer is now a word used non-pejoratively, right? I don't tend to use the word poetess when I am not in my persona as the poetess. So.
Well, I love your description of her as a kind of know-it-all, but good-hearted, right?
Good-hearted. She means well, yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you read two more letters to the poetess.
Okay. So she answers a whole all different kinds of advice, some from poets, some from non-poets. And when she answers, they often sign their names in clever ways, like occupationally hazarded is about to, you'll hear the letter, and she writes to him, she shortens that to O, acronymically O-H, or it, someone signs their name, it's the chromosomes, huh? And she will shorten that to itch. So kind of following Dan Savage, the sex columnist, example.
Yes.
Dear poetess, I am a chemist. People at parties are always discovering this and saying to me, a chemist, my favorite element is iridium. This is driving me crazy. Signed, occupationally hazarded. Dear, oh dear, it could be worse. Imagine if you had to hear, a poetess? My favorite poem is The Road Not Taken. 100 times a year. Love the poetess. Dear poetess, but seriously, what's the difference between a male poetess and a female poetess? Signed, it's the chromosomes, huh? Dear itch, okay, there is one difference. A male poetess can say, getting soft, dude, getting soft, while delivering a punch to another male poetess's expanding gut. A female poetess can never, ever, ever say this to her sisters in poetry, with punching or without. Love the poetess.
That's great. And again, Daisy Fried reading from her new collection of poetry, Women's Poetry, Poems and Advice. I love, first of all, the idea of a poet or a poetess having an advice column, because frankly, you know, who would go to a poet for advice? And then I've always felt with all advice columns is no one ever takes advice. I mean, the whole, it's such a charade, if you know what I mean.
Well, I always wonder why they're asking, why are they not talking to their husbands about this, or, you know, their doctors, you know, I just don't get it. But I love advice columns. They're fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. But I, as I said, when I read the advice, I always say to myself, they're not going to do this.
No, and that, I don't know that the poetess's advice is always doable, so...
Exactly. Anything you want to add to that, Lynn?
I'm a huge fan of advice columnists too.
Oh yeah.
And in fact, in our book, Valerie Fox's, and my book, Poems for the Writing, we have this advice column poem where it's a little bit, you know, great minds think alike, Daisy. where you have a two-part prose poem. One is the letter from the person who's suffering, and it's supposed to be kind of hopefully wacky, and then the advice is usually just as wacky and entertaining and off the wall, and yeah.
Well, you do have this Poems for the Writing prompts for poets that you've written with Valerie Fox, and what was the genesis of this book? Why did you write this book?
Well, it was actually the brainchild of Valerie Fox, and we both teach poetry writing, and we tend to make up prompts. And so she said, well, why don't we create a book of these prompts? So we developed 14, and we classroom tested and workshop tested them. And it turned out that they were pretty successful. And so we thought, well, this is good. Collect them, share them, and share some of the poems that were generated by them. Mm. And it just blossomed into something really cool.
Well, the one I turned to is the I Hate poem. I don't know why I turned to that, but I mean, how is that a good prompt?
Well, invective is so much fun.
It is fun.
And when it's comic, it's even more fun. And the I Hate poem, we just tell the students, you know, develop kind of a list poem of all the things you can't stand. And it just opens up incredible doors, and the poems are usually hilarious, and they are allowed to kind of make fun of what bedevils them. So it's a little therapeutic maybe, but it's also like it turns into a good poem.
Well, and I mean, so you teach poetry, you teach creative writing. I mean, is there, do perhaps young poets, because you teach at Penn and also at Drexel, do they feel that, you know, my poem has to be weighty and serious and 'cause many of these are playful and fun.
Well, sometimes when they're weighty and serious, they turn into kind of convoluted, he said, she said poems that don't have shape. And the beauty of prompts is that it helps people shape their thinking.
Right.
So that's doesn't exactly answer your question, but it gives them a way to write about subjects more artfully, because it's not the weightiness that's so important. It's the shape of the poem, I think, and how well, it's presented on the page.
And they have something to say, too, I would think. Do you have a certain approach to teaching creative writing, Daisy?
Yeah, well, I teach mostly poetry workshops, I give assignments to my students. I give them a prompt every week, and they write a poem a week. And what I do, I love Lynn's prompts, and I've generated lists like that, never published them. But what I do with my students, I tend to try to get them to focus on different craft issues. So I will give them something that gets them to think about voice or line breaks or pacing in a poem. And so I think a lot of poetry prompts, whether it's an I hate prompt or some other sort of prompt, probably there's a poet thinking about behind it. I would like people to learn about voice or about, you know, syntax or the kinds of building blocks of poetry.
Let me get, looks like Robert from Skipack to join our conversation. And Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question.
Oh, don't be embarrassed.
When I hear these poems, they're beautiful, but I think of short stories. And I know I should know this from high school, but what makes it a poem rather than a short story?
Well, I think that's a great question. Daisy, you want to take that?
That is a wonderful question, and it's a perennial question. Lynn and I are both narrative poets.
You are.
Narrative poetry has been around since Homer, you know. What makes a poem a poem? You can talk about things like compression. You can talk about things like, I guess a story, the typical thing to say is a story, in a story you have a protagonist and something happens as the protagonist is going along life and the protagonist changes or fails to change. In a poem, I think it's not so much about change, but more about stasis. Once you say that,
about not changing.
It's the tip of the iceberg. The poem is more about the moment. The piece of the iceberg that's sort of sticking out of the water that you can see, but you know there's a lot underneath it. Of course, the minute you say that, you can point to tons of stories where nothing changes,
right.
Poems where things do develop.
Exactly.
So I guess I tend not to worry too much about it. If somebody says it's a poem, fine. And then I want to know, is it good and why?
What do you think, Lynn?
I totally concur with Daisy. It's always a mystery. You know, if you took this this poem and you ran it together like a paragraph, well, what's the difference between that and a poem? Mm-hmm. So, you know,
should we worry about that, or what we call it?
I think that if it reads like a poem and it enchants you like a poem, then it's a poem. I'm with Daisy on that.
Robert, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Daisy.
I visited my daughter's kindergarten a couple days ago to do poetry with the kids there, and a 5-year-old raised her hand and said, "What's a poem?" And I was like, "Oh no, it's starting already." So I did that teacher thing and I said, "Well, what do you think a poem is?"
Well, of course.
And
what,
they all
what
told
did
me.
She say?
Well, she said, "It's where you can do anything you want." And another girl said, "So you can express yourself." And a little boy said, "You can tell a story in a poem." And I said, "You're all right." And then I quickly changed the subject and got them to do the word game that we were doing.
And that's Daisy Fried, who joins us along with Lynn Levin, both poets who live and work here in the Delaware Valley. And they both have new collections of poetry. Lynn's is called Miss Plastique, and Daisy's is called Women's Poetry. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Lynn, I'd love to have you read Faux King in the Parking Lot.
Thank you. I'd love to. So this is F-A-U-X, like faux pearls, and King, of course, is Elvis the King. Faux King in the Parking Lot. It was in the parking lot at the Samba Club between sets at the Huxley wedding, and he was an Elvis impersonator. We'd eyed each other during Love Me Tender. Through his heavy lashes, he nodded me over. Ah, to be taken without being adored, though to be adored without being taken is also a wonder. Those silver studs on his white suit, the Brill cream, I didn't know they still made it. Left oil stains, damn it, on my nice linen skirt. Techno boinked from a passing car, and we pumped to it. He said his wife didn't understand him. I never sleep with happily married men, I told him. Curling his lip, the faux king shot, then you ought to sleep with your husband. I should have slapped him, but his thighs were hot, and the side of the car was cold.
That's a great poem. And just the faux king curling his lip. I mean, we know what that looks like, don't we?
Yeah, Elvis's snarl.
Then you ought to sleep with your husband. Ouch.
Yeah, isn't that so rude of him?
And was there something that inspired this?
Yes, actually. I knew someone who used to waitress at a catering hall. And she went out for a smoke break once during a wedding. And she saw the Elvis impersonator and a wedding guest getting together in the parking lot. And I heard about this. I said, I got to write about this.
That's great. Yeah. Daisy, I'd love to have you read History's 2000 July.
Yes, this is one piece of a longer sequence called Attenti alle Zingari, which means beware of the gypsies. The sequence is set in Rome and perhaps is about being an American in the world in the OOs. But this piece is History's 2000 July. My first time in Rome, our honeymoon, a cheerful place, jubilee year. Slaves and prisoners are released, debts forgiven. God's mercies particularly manifest, and Catholics are absolved of their sins if they walk to all seven basilicas. They troop in footsore double group tour lines behind a woman holding aloft a pink umbrella. She murmurs facts to her mic. They wear headset receivers. There's no more cacophony in art places, just watery hiss of tour guide whisper. In the Palazzo Doria Pamphili, Mary, resting on the flight to Egypt, bends wearily over her four-square baby, his tiny penis pointing from the canvas, innocent and clean as a cap gun. "Are you hungry, sister?" a fat guy says to a nun. "Would you like some McDonald's?" History hasn't happened yet. On the crowded flight home, I sit next to a Texan who's never been out of Texas before. She went to Lourdes, then Rome. She's sinless. We fly over New York, Selva Oscura. What are those two tall buildings down there?
And again, Daisy Fried reading a poem from her new book, Histories, and we're nearly out of time here. But when I read that last line, I just gasped.
Thank you.
It's like when you see that image now in New York and the buildings either are there or aren't there, it's still so shocking.
Well, I was so this woman said this to me, and I was surprised she didn't know what they were. And when that happened, we didn't know what was going to happen the following year. And I remembered it when I was writing about Rome. Yeah. It presented itself as something to put there.
Well, great poetry. So much fun. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Lynn Levin, Daisy Fried, our guests. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.